Hello, Susanna Lopez here, actor turned barrister turned broadcaster turned true crime writer and proud member of Sisters in Crime Australia. Welcome to the Scarlet Stiletto Bites podcast. For over 30 years now, Sisters in Crime Australia has supported our women crime writers, both true crime and fiction, and some criminal literary talent has been unearthed. Among many awards, there's an annual prize for short crime fiction, the Scarlet Stiletto Awards. And for those of you who prefer your stories by ear, in 2023 we commenced this podcast series, Scarlet Stiletto Bites, to celebrate the sisters' 30th anniversary. Each story is short, but not always sweet. Expect twisted tales, quirky humour, and a frisson of feminism. Please support us by following, sharing, reviewing, and generally spreading the word. We have no paywall. Melbourne was, for a time, the gangland capital of Australia. Lots of deaths and stoushes between the gang in blue and the criminal gangs. And still, mysteries remain. Today's story looks back. Trouble in Nine Acts by Kim Westwood. Scarlet Stiletto and Judges Award 2011. 1. You'd think by now I'd know the shape of trouble. The innocuous envelope from the letterbox, carried absently to the kitchen, cat purring on the sunlit bench, kettle coming to the boil, then two words written in red calligraphy. Find me. I bring the page to my nose and sniff. Strawberries. Two fruity words to tempt me from my straight and narrow. Pete, my boss, says I attract it like a beacon, that I got it from my dad. He knew him in their young gun days, before disappearing hairlines, brown corduroys and blocked arteries. Dad, a divorcee by the time he died, left his house and PI business to me, his prodigal daughter, to force me into some stability. But I'd already seen what a lifetime of sleuthing for insurance companies and suspicious partners does to a person's opinion of humanity. And so, after 4 years of sob stories, paranoias and deceptions, I sold the business and came to work at the Book Nook. I thought trouble would leave me be because of that. But I was wrong. It's obvious you can't help yourself, Pete says after I tell him about my mysterious letter. You're a natural. Sleuth? No, trouble magnet. It's just a shame your dad isn't still around to help you toughen up.
I'm tough,
I answer, and he snorts. Yeah, right, like Pavlova, soft and gooey under the crust. I'd ignore him if he weren't ex-uniform. 35 years on the job before the Rolex handshake. Come on, Flea, admit it. You can't resist a mystery. You're like Nancy Drew with a slouch pants and a buzz cut, except you fall for the crims, he tisks at me.
That was once, I say. And under duress.
My last client and object of desire turned out to be a money launderer. She wanted me for an alibi. I just wanted her in my creaky bed. Say it, he instructs, professorial over his half glasses. Okay, I'm a Pavlova. Happy now? He beams, smug bastard. Pete had bailed me out. Sometimes it helps to know an ex-cop. In return, I promised him a model employee. At work every day, a diligent seller of books. But he knows better than I do how the city is Janus faced, and we are just squatters on someone else's real estate.
Between us, in a murky underworld, is a catalogue of rogues plying their seductive charms on everyone, including the suspecting. Pete knows well how trouble is an aphrodisiac. 2. The Book Nook is more an enthusiast's haunt than a tourist shop. The shop front is devoid of signage, but for a faded number on the glass door and the words Gaudry and Son Haberdashers shadowing the brick. Its narrow, cluttered spaces are not user-friendly. The lighting's so dim that customers need to bring night vision binoculars to see the titles. Books pile on books in dusty shelves, the overflow formed into tilting stalagmites on the floor. Stock-taking is a running joke, Pete's system being neither alphabetical nor by type, but is based on where he put the book when he first got it. In this particular area, he has a photographic memory that stretches back 7 years to when the shop was emptied of its ancient rolls of fabric and drawers of fastenings, some of those items still languishing in the storeroom underneath. All my suggestions that he tout for custom by advertising the shop's name on the front window or putting weekly specials on a billboard, he shrugs off as gimmicky. The punters know where we are. They don't need crass incentives, he assures me. So, more often than not, we get to sit and watch the customers come and go from Caravaggio's, the busy cafe across the road. Their regulars are a steady stream. We know them all by sight and when they arrive for their daily fix. Like no theatre, there's a lot of repetition over a long time. It's soothing and peculiarly addictive. Then there are the walk-ins. What about that one? A suit with a briefcase is shaking the rain off a black umbrella. Taurus, he says, demanding, authoritarian, a beast in bed. This is our game. We never tire of it. Got a number out of 10? 2. Minimal value on the Richter scale of interest. Oh, what about her? Pete asks. A slender woman in boots, a short skirt and jean jacket has arrived outside and is checking both ways along the street. A newbie. The Richter scale ratchets up several notches. She flicks one last look behind her, then ducks inside. Aquarius? Artistic and flighty. Out of 10? I wait a beat too long. 5? You rationing numerals today, Pete tries to goad me into a confession of interest. Our doorbell tinkles and two lean ferals slink in. Lissa and Paul have turned up for replacement batteries for their book light. How's it all going? I inquire, handing over the triple A's. Got another place. Lissa chews on her bleached end of hair as she speaks, her words swallow before they leave her mouth. It's nicer, Paul pockets the batteries. It would want to be. The previous one was a dump, literally. Oh, what did you think of the last book? Paul screws up his face, remembering. I liked it till the city got saved by angels. That was a bit rich, I agree. Pete has disappeared between the shelves. He comes back, slim volume in hand. Try this. The guy wakes up as a cockroach. The book goes under Liz's raggedy jumper and they slink out. The light was a present from Pete. He'd found them one night, spooned together under a blanket in his shop entrance. They were reading The Hobbit in the dark. My boss, tight as a fish's arsehole, can still surprise me. 3. It takes me 20 minutes to walk to the shop from my house in East Melbourne. I like to go slow enough to notice things like the woolly wagtails dive bombing a marauder bird in their territory or the surprise crocuses in a previously bare front yard. When I arrive, Pete's ferreting through a box of seconds, swapped for the cost of a movie ticket. "Any mysterious new messages?" he inquires. "Nah," I dump my stuff behind the counter. "How about getting us both an engine starter?" He likes his coffee double shot. "Sure." He didn't see who just went into Caravaggio's, but I did. I cross to the pedestrian safety island and wait for a tram to pass. I have no plan, I just want to get up close. I sidle in beside her to place my order. Straight black hair angles to a fringe, ending at the collar. Her right hand rests on the metal counter, two fingers minutely drum. I eye a plate of Italian pastries under a glass cloche. I smell short crust and icing sugar and strawberries. She glances at me. Oh my, green eyes. "Lose anything?" my boss asks. For a moment I'm perplexed. Oh, I have his coffee but forgot mine. Of course, she turns up at Caravaggio's the next day, and the next. After 5 days, I turn to Pete. I think she has hungry ghosts. My turn for someone haunted by their past. "What a surprise," he says. "I suppose it's a waste of time telling you not to get involved." I'm not involved. I'm an interested bystander who gets coffee at the same cafe. Pete harumphs. Each of those 5 days I'd hurriedly volunteered to get our morning fix. Enid arrives. We hear the trolley first, followed by the smell of wet newspaper, cigarette butts and mothballs. She's one of our regulars, but it's not books she's after. "What's for lunch?" A gnarled and dirty hand goes palm up on the counter. "Cheese, tomato and chutney on rye." I take the package from beneath the counter and pass it over. I'd made hers when I'd made mine. The sandwich is devoured, not a crumb dropped. She hands me back the wrapping. "Flea."
"What's that short for?"
"Felicity."
"You don't look like a Felicity."
As the trolley rattles off down the pavement, I wonder what Enid used to do. Even bag ladies have had other lives. I asked Pete once if he knew her when he was a cop. His face got a back-in-5 minutes look. "Enid's special," was all he'd say, "and she really likes your sandwiches." 4. Melbourne's back streets and alleyways are Dickensian in the rain. I love their damp, graffitied brick, their hidden entrances and no-name doors. I draw my coat around me and hurry on. A second unstamped envelope was waiting in my mailbox this morning. "Finders, keepers," written in strawberry script. The scent is familiar now, very familiar. It's the scent of the woman at Caravaggio's. And so now the sleuth in me is like a beagle on the trail of contraband. Mist congeals between dripping eaves, runnels of water course down leaky guttering. She's ahead under an umbrella, the same jean jacket as on the first day. I didn't see it then, but it has a patch sewn on the back, a hand closed round a lightning bolt. Opposite the Queen Vic Market, she pushes on a rusty gate at an unloved terrace row. I slow, then quicken again to purposeful, taking one swift look. She's just behind the gate, facing out. "Are you following me?" I stop, caught. Yes. "Why?" "You forgot this." I hold up the soggy bag of pastries she'd left on Caravaggio's counter. "Oh, thanks. That was kind of you." She takes the bag and I linger at the gate feeling duplicitous and confused. This is her opportunity to fess up to the messages. And what if she's not the writer after all? When she disappears behind the door, I notice a ceramic plaque beside it, the same motif as on her jacket. Well, what do you think? I've told Pete about the hand and lightning bolt. It's ringing no bells, he replies. Could be a company logo or a club shield. Well, I feel like I've seen it somewhere before. Pete gives me the evil eye of reproach. You promised no more Nancy Drew. My memory banks are refusing to divulge, but at least I have her name, Amber. I swing the card stand idly. How come you never order any new cards? Well, I will when those ones are sold. But if you get new stuff, the regulars would trawl the stands again. They're bored shitless with these ones. No, you are. They're perfectly happy with what's on offer. 5. Several more words exchanged at Caravaggio's, and she said yes to a drink at my favourite bar. I leave work humming. The Mojo Bar's blue neon glows. A jukebox pumps out Ministry of Sound. She stirs the olives on their stick in her martini and tells me she makes monsters for a living. I can't help the startle reflex. Is that the darkness I sense lurking at the edge of her? Theme park creatures, she explains. I design them. Oh, I say, intrigued. Sounds like fun. Fun. She considers the notion like something pickled in a jar. Yes. We go silent as the bartender serves a customer beside us. And you work in a bookshop, her gaze pins me. Now I am the pickled thing. Yes. What about before that? BA, travel, pub jobs, then a PI, like my dad. Did you work for him? No, he left his business to me in his will. You took over his cases? Not unless they asked. Now he's gone. A lifetime's toil is in my attic, being converted into bedding by the mice. I didn't mention the one thing the rodents can't recycle. His handgun, filed under G. Her turn to tell. She finally admits to the messages. She spied me 2 weeks ago getting takeaways from Caravaggio's and asked Luigi, the barista, about me. He mentioned what I used to do. She could have propositioned me at the bookshop, but decided I might appreciate a more mysterious way, so she followed me home and left the envelope in my letterbox. I'm impressed. It's nothing if not inventive. You do this often? I inquire. She laughs. Ah, you're the inspirational first. My second drink loosens muscles, anxieties, inhibitions. We flirt, and every corpuscle in me starts to zing. I feel miraculously transformed from ordinary to interesting. She draws the olives one by one off the stick with her teeth, her lips seducing me. My heart beats in my head like I'm underwater. Suddenly she leans across and we're kissing. Your place now, she says. The best place to hide a lie is behind a truth. My father used to say that, and he saw plenty of both. We spend the night and the next 3 in bed at my place. Between sex and food and sex, we reveal snippets of our lives. She's an only child and was placed in foster care after her father died and her mother abandoned her. I have no such dire thing to tell about my own childhood, which was marked by continuity and boredom. My bedroom window looks out at the passing world.
Mornings over tea and toast, we play the shoe game with the people walking by. You can tell a lot about the wearer by their choice of footwear and their gait. First, their personality, then their mood, their injuries. I feel mildly guilty. It's like the game Pete and I devised at work, without the Richter scale of interest. "You're losing the plot," Pete warns on my fourth successive late arrival. "She's got you like a fish on a line." "A happy fish," I mumble. "For now." Pete, of course, is right. Trouble. Down it comes like Icarus, wings folded in surrender, plummeting, landing, whomp! My front step flocked with feathers like an accident with an eiderdown. My welcome mat stained the black of privet berries. And my inspired lover up to her delightful neck in it. 6. The cat gives Amber his imprimatur, a thorough hand-licking. She stays over often and leaves me post-it notes with hearts and kisses. I give her the spare key to my house, ignoring the nagging question over why I've never been invited inside hers. Eventually, I ask about the patch on her jacket and motif by her door. Her foster parents gave them to her when she was 18, the only mementos of her birth family. "Do you know anything about them?" "No, that part of my life is gone." "Her past a closed book. Who am I to invoke the hungry ghosts?" The Manchester Unity Arcade is a shortcut between Swanson and Collins Street. Just past the building's lifts, there's a bagel place. I'm waiting for mine to be heated, looking at the plaster frieze above burnished copper lift doors. And there it is, a hand clutching a lightning bolt. The hand is attached to the arm of a muscled and valorous labourer. Below him on a pennant are some words in Latin, "Vires in Fidelitas." I use Pete's clunky old work computer to do a search. The Latin translates as "strength in fidelity." Well, what has this got to do with Amber and her lost family? I do a bit more digging. The Latin phrase turns up as a credo of a Melbourne establishment family. In the 1930s, they invested heavily in the then new Manchester Unity building. I search on the name. The family was suspected of dealings with a flourishing Melbourne underworld. The son inherited the business and was eventually jailed on corruption charges. His son took over. In 1991, he was found floating in the Yarra. So, Amber's family was a family of rogues. I feel bad rifling through her forebears' closet and log off. This time I don't reveal to Pete the neural firing and wiring going on in my Snoop's brain. I keep my brain's activities to myself. A southerly makes whirligigs of the litter in the street and Enid's late for lunch. I take the plastic tub of last night's baked veggies to the laneway she frequents nearby, chosen on a day like this for its weather-protected alcoves. I see the trolley and then I see Amber. I stop, nonplussed. Enid emerges from an alcove and shuffles anxiously from foot to foot while my girlfriend rummages through her trolley load of plastic bags. I retreat into a doorway and wait. "Enid, I've got to know. Just tell me quick and it'll be like ripping off a band-aid over in a flash." I hand her my bribe and a spoon and she starts shoveling it in. "Go away," she says, mouthful. "I'm sick of you now." "Enid, please, I saw her with you," she sniffs. "You don't have to know things that are bad for you."
The wind gusts along the lane and I shiver. How's your place holding up? I ask.
None of your beeswax. What's it to you?
I've seen her shelter. It's a lumpy sleeping bag and blue tarp under the rail viaduct beside the river. Suddenly she pulls up her trouser layers to show me a dark welt on her shin.
See that? Bumped into a wall. Fell over a cat. Got kicked by a horse.
Enid has three scenarios for everything, none of them the truth.
Some things scab over but never heal. She pokes my sternum with her spoon. That'll be your problem too, if you don't watch out.
I'll be extra careful, but who is she?
Bugger off, you and your nosy parkering.
Please, I'm begging, abject. Tell me who I've fallen for. Two dirty hands go to her eyes. My daughter. 7. I fix on Pete. Did you know Enid had a daughter? He looks at me, then sighs. She was taken away by child protection. Why? The family court deemed Enid an unfit mother. She got in with the wrong crowd. What happened to the kid? New name, new family. She was 6, poor little bugger. Be in her mid-20s now. I hope she's made a good life for herself. No need to hope. You've been passing comment on her every day for a week. His jaw drops. Enid's daughter? Here? Then it dawns on him. Not the woman you've been dating. I'm serious about her, Pete. I describe the bagel moment and my research, then what just happened in the laneway. He's shoving bits and pieces off the counter into his pockets. I squeezed it out of Enid, I say. I'm not proud. Get your coat, he tells me. He talks as we walk. Enid was a messenger for the Melbourne underworld. She married into one of its most notorious families and then became a snitch for us. Actually, it was your dad who helped us recruit her. His line of work traversed both worlds. After her husband, Ivan, drowned and the child protection workers took her daughter, we thought it best to get her out of town while we figured out what had happened. We never did. Then she disappeared on us. She was no innocent. She had a few tricks of her own up her sleeve. 15 years later, just after your dad died, there she was with her trolley at the bookshop door. She couldn't stay away from Melbourne. She loves this city. Well, it's been 20 years. What's there to panic over? And it may seem 2 cards shy of a full hand, but she's lost none of her memory cells, and nor has the wrong crowd. Ivan's younger brother runs the family business now. He'll be after her for what she knows if her daughter unwittingly lets on. How on earth had Amber found her? Mid-stride, I stop. You and Dad helped her. Would Amber remember that? Doubt it. I think back to our first date, her saying she'd scope me out at Caravaggio's, then of Enid's daily visits to the bookshop, and a bad thought hits. What if I'm the link? We search the usual daytime haunts, but Enid is in none of them. Eventually we find her crouched beneath her tarp under the viaduct. I lift the tarp and she clutches something to her chest, moaning incoherencies. I feel responsible for opening old wounds. Pete gently retrieves a battered metal locket from her and I pry it open. I expect a memento of her fractured family, but it's a weather-worsted photograph of her and Dad.
My boss has gone silent and inscrutable beside me. I hand Enid back the locket, the neurons busily wiring together new scenarios in my head. I say I need to check something at home, and we agree to meet at the bookshop in an hour after he's got Enid to a safer place. 8. I know she's left me before I even get in the door. Her things are gone, her notes to me laid out like blood-speckled hankies on my bed. The new one has two parting words. Losers, weepers. I lean heavily against the wall. She lied to me. She knew her family history all along. She said her mother abandoned her. I guess she figured out who helped Enid disappear. I climb the pull-down steps and flick the switch for the bare bulb. Oh, I haven't been up here for years. Unlike Amber, whose elaborate seduction was to get into my attic and my father's things. Case files have been removed from boxes and placed in piles, systematically gone through. I think of all the opportunities she's had to search for clues and cringe. She's the real sleuth, not me. Untouched in the corner is a box of my stuff from when I was a kid. I go over. There are plastic toys and de-limbed dolls, crusty paintbrushes. I haul out a large scrapbook, then rifle through the crayon scrawls, and loose pages fall like confetti. More photos of Enid and my father. Scribbled love notes. Room numbers on hotel memo paper. Oh, my poor mother. In all the years of slow disintegrating marriage, did she ever suspect? I leave some more. A newspaper clipping flutters down, a report on Ivan's drowning, with a brief mention of the passerby who found him. Dad. I go back to a neatly alphabetized pile of folders and open the one laid across the top. It's a dossier on Pete's investigation into Ivan's family business and his one cop crusade to bring a scion of the Melbourne underworld to heel. The last, a photocopied sheet, is an urgent request for child protection. The signature is Pete's. I glance further down the pile. It's missing G. The realization crashes in. Amber, piecing together the mystery of her father's death and Enid's desertion, has found someone to blame. Inside the book nook, my father's gun is pointed at Pete's head. Amber! It wasn't his fault. It was my dad's. Two pairs of eyes dart to mine, then back to each other's. I produce the scrapbook notes, minus the news clipping. The memory of my father hurts like it never has before. Enid will tell you now. They were having an affair, and when Ivan died, she must have been afraid his family would find out and go after Dad. She was in big trouble, and you were in the firing line as emotional persuasion. I think that's why she disappeared that day 20 years ago and never came to claim you. It's how come she didn't turn up here until my father passed away. Why here? Amber demands, gun still aimed at Pete. You had it in for us, she accuses him. Is that the reason you sicked the welfare workers onto me? No, he answers. Enid begged me to. The shock registers on Amber's face, and the gun muzzle dips. Flea's got it right, he continues, his voice modulated for calm. Enid thought if I reported her to child protection, they'd take you somewhere safe. The family had no love for her. With Ivan gone, she knew they wouldn't stop until the details had been wrenched out of her. After that, he shrugs. Well, at least this way you had the chance of a different life. 9. Two coffees wisp steam in their cardboard cups. Pete fingers the clipping. I'm really sorry about your dad. Don't be. Right now I'm just angry. Later I'll grieve the breach of familial trust. He slowly shakes his head. I should have asked the hard questions long ago, but I wanted a quiet retirement and Enid wanted anonymity. Now it's about closure for her daughter. Amber. Gone again. Well, at least she'd left the gun. Her first message said, find me. But I never did. She had a secret self she'd kept carefully quarantined. Enid was right. There's a piece cut out of me that won't properly heal. They'll reopen the investigation into Ivan's death, Pete says. I know some retired cops who won't welcome that. So ditch this stuff. I eye the clipping. How much do I really want to know? Can't. Amber's too good a sleuth. She'll dig until she finds all the dirt, including that Enid was an informant. Then finally they'll have it out. They might even reconcile. Not if Amber's extended family take her back into the fold. Enid's safety will depend on where her daughter decides to put her loyalty. Pete's safety too, I'm thinking. I'm reminded of the Latin, strength in fidelity, on the frieze in the Manchester Unity Arcade. Enid had transgressed the family credo. Oh, you don't need to be the big hero, I tell him. You've got your long service, thank you, watch. He shifts his weight to face me. Flea, I never got the Rolex handshake. Pardon? Your father was there when Ivan went in the river. We knew that because he was secretly working for us. He swore Ivan was playing chicken with his own gun and shot himself. The way my colleagues saw it, that meant one less crim in Melbourne. Why look a gift horse in the mouth? I'm ashamed to say that I agreed. And we weren't the only ones who thought that. And Ivan's body was trundled speedily through the morgue. Years later, the autopsy report resurfaced. The bullet hole didn't match the weapon recovered from the scene. I look hard at my father's gun. Chambers emptied, laid on a stack of self-help books. An internal investigation cited sloppy forensic work. I was cleared of any wrongdoing, but quietly advised to retire. And now the truth is going to loose a wrecking ball. I watched the coffee drinkers coming and going from Caravaggio's. Will it swing at you? For a bit, he leans two cardiganed elbows on the counter beside me. Might need you to mind the shop. The end. Thanks so much for listening. We'd love to get your feedback and we'd love to reach more listeners. Our website is sistersincrime.org.au and our email address is admin@sistersincrime.org.au. Until next Friday then, when we bring you another scintillating story from Australian women crime creative.